the Well Read Podcast, a bi-weekly discussion on books and reading. I'm Anne.
And I'm Hallie.
And we're librarians with the Beaufort County Library in South Carolina. This week, we're talking about books that make us laugh. So last week we did, or last 2 weeks ago, we did books that made us cry.
Yes.
And so this is our...
our antidote.
Yes. So did you think it was easier coming up with books that made you laugh, or...?
Actually, no. I think it was harder for me to come up with books that made me laugh. Partly because, even though I say, oh, that book made me laugh, usually they literally do not make me laugh. It's more in my mind, like, oh, that was a funny book.
Right.
Or, you know, that was... I sort of smile. And I guess I just read sadder books, or books with more emotional depth and less of the humor aspect.
Right.
But, no, I still had quite a few to choose from, but I felt like it was harder to describe them, for sure, when I was trying to think about how I was going to talk about them.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think it's really easy for me to identify what makes me laugh. If it's a movie or like comedy, I know that there are certain things that I'm really attracted to in comedy. And for books, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of hard for me to figure out, like, I could find books that made me laugh, but it was hard for me to sort of tease out what it was that was making me laugh.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think it's as easy.
I think that humor, and they say this in acting too, I've heard actors say that comedy can be really hard, or harder than drama.
Uh-huh.
And I'm guessing that writing humor is really difficult too, because humor is something that is so personal. Something that strikes you as funny might not strike me as funny.
Right.
And so something that strikes the writer as funny might not strike the general audience as
funny.
Right.
When we were sort of talking about how to put this episode together, we kind of talked about what the humor genre is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of a difference between the humor genre and books that make us laugh.
Right.
Because you can just have fiction that it's sort of has a funny tone.
Right.
To it, but then there's actual books that are like in the library
under humor. Yeah. And those are usually like essays.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say? Or
like comedian sort of memoirs.
Right.
I think,
yeah.
Which can fall under a couple of different categories.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that to me, when I think of comedians' memoirs, I picture like Bob Hope and all these people that are super not my generation and not really my style of humor. And then I thought, oh no, there's Bossy Pants.
Right, that's the first one I
thought
of.
And books that are really current, and I just don't put those in the same category at all.
Yeah.
I picture the cover of Sign Language, which just
seems
kind of late 80s, 90s to me.
Exactly.
So.
But yeah, I feel like there's been a resurgence of those, like you mentioned Bossy Pants and the Amy Poehler book, and then Mindy Kaling has a book out, and then another one coming out this fall, and I'm blanking, but I'm sure that there have been more. Oh, Lena Dunham has a series. I read that, and I wouldn't really consider that one that makes me laugh, but it's sort of in that same vein of not a straight memoir, because lots of times there are essays on other topics than just their lives or their biography, basically, but... it's the comedian's slant on a memoir, not just a straight narrative about their life.
Right.
Yeah.
And then there's the kind of the blogger.
Yes.
I don't know, those aren't really memoirs exactly, but kind of.
So kind of,
like,
right.
They're talking about their lives and they're talking about the sort of crazy things that happen in their lives.
Yes.
But I wouldn't put them exactly in the same category as Tina Fey's book either. So.
And there's also this whole trend of books where somebody will do something for a year or a predetermined period of time and then write about it. And lots of those seem to have a humorous slant to them, or an angle that makes you not laugh out loud maybe, but just it's sort of funny because they're embarking on something that a normal person wouldn't do for a year.
Right.
A.J. Jacobs does those where he does something. He read the whole
Encyclopedia
Britannica, or he lived by the Bible's rules for a year. Things like that. I mean, the premise of it is funny because most people don't do those things.
And there's kind of absurdities that come from it because they're doing all of it in such a condensed space of time that there's always terrible things that happen to them, which I enjoy.
Yes. So having said that, should we start with our picks for
Tell
this
me
week?
Your first one.
So my first one is called Texts from Jane Eyre by Mallory Ortberg, and she is a writer for the website The Toast, which I'm really not all that familiar with because I don't read it, but I've heard about it, and it's, I guess, a humor, current events kind of website. And this started as a series on the site where she write these imagined text conversations between characters in famous books, namely between Rochester and Jane Eyre and Jane Eyre. And when we got this book at the library, I first just flipped through it to see kind of what it was all about, and ended up sitting there for 10 minutes and reading them, because it's all in text format, so it's a really quick read. You know, it's easy to just go from one thing right to the next, and it's funny. It made me, like I said earlier, sometimes when I say a book made me laugh, it's an internal laughter,
right.
But this one, I was laughing out loud, because it's things like, she imagines Scarlett O'Hara texting Ashley Wilkes, like all these sensual sort of trying to lure him away from Melanie, because you know if she had a smartphone in her hand,
right,
she would be doing this. And then from the title, the Jane Eyre ones, Mr. Rochester is always texting in all caps to Jane Eyre. But it's not just characters in books. She also imagines texts from famous authors. It's a great book for people who like to read, because you definitely don't have to have read all of the books she talks about. I mean, she covers a whole bunch of books back from classic times to present day, but it's good to have just a glancing knowledge of what they're about, or else I think a lot of the jokes would just not work for you. In fact, some of them I wasn't familiar with the books, and I could see sort of why they would be funny, but I'm sure they would be much funnier if I had known the story.
Right.
But she doesn't just stick with the classics. She does cover things like Harry Potter, the Sweet Valley High books, Atlas Shrugged, Nancy Drew. She trusts her readers to know which characters she's talking about. There's no identification of who is actually texting. It's just you get the name of the book or the name of the author and then the text conversation. So you don't know who's in the conversation. You have to pick that up from the clues. And she does a really good job. It's fairly easy to just pick it up right away of who exactly is talking. And typically it's, you know, the main character of the book. You know, it's Daisy from The Great Gatsby texting after a car accident for somebody to come pick her up. So you know who it is from the text. And it's just so incredibly smart and sort of snappy, the way it's very quick-witted. And I just love that type of humor. It makes me laugh. And, of course, the book angle will always get me no matter what.
Right.
So that is Text from Jane Eyre by Mallory Ortberg.
It sounds super fun.
It is super fun. And it's, like I said, a very quick read. So
yeah,
it's one I could read in an hour or two on an afternoon.
Yeah. So my first pick is called Dear Committee Members by Julie Schumacher. This came out last year. I've had my eye on it for a really long time and have given it as gifts because I have a lot of friends who exist in this world, which I'll describe. So the main character is Jason Fitcher, and he's a middle-aged professor of creative writing and English at a small university in the Midwest. And so as most English departments are facing huge budget cuts, he talks about this quite a bit. So they have no staff, they have no budget, they're losing all their funding from the university. And all those funds are now going to higher profile departments that seem to make a lot more money for the university. So they share this building with the economics department, who's undergoing a renovation. So they're getting all this gorgeous new stuff while he literally has rainwater pouring through his closed window because there's so many just faults in this building. So he's had one successful novel published, and then he wrote a series of other novels that didn't work so well, and he has alienated everyone in his life because he writes about his own life in his novels. And so he has an ex-wife that's furious with him, he has ex-girlfriends, all these different people in his life that are angry that he sort of outed their relationship. And so as a result of this, he's just this super curmudgeonly annoyed person, and he's furious he can't write these novels anymore the way he wants to because he's so bogged down by the bureaucracy of his teaching, and that he has to write all these letters of recommendation for people. So that's the premise of the novel. It's all in letter form, it's an epistolary novel, and they're all either asking for favors from people or recommending people for different positions or students that have asked him for letters of recommendation. So you learn the whole backstory of his life and all the plot that is happening throughout the book through these letters, and it's really not about the plot, it's about the characters and really his character. So since there's not a lot of plot, then it really is just depending on the humor of what he's writing. So I personally found it funny because when I was in college, the university I went to devoted all this money to the science buildings. They were getting these new facilities, and the language and lit building that I spent a lot of time in literally didn't have a working clock. And so I really identified with all of his complaints and sort of the injustice of all of this. And he writes it in a way where it's such flowery writing and so biting in his writing that you just know he spent so many hours ruminating over his anger, and that cracks me up so much. And then I also have a lot of friends who are PhD students or have recently completed their PhDs, and they have all these horror stories of what it's like to work for universities and to deal with students. And so I found a lot of humor in that and realizing how true to life these stories are of students that are asking for letters of recommendation when they got like low D's in their class. So I enjoy those kinds of things. But the thing that really makes it stick out to me is how passive aggressive this character is and how he will sabotage people just for the sake of his personal vendettas, and he'll call out students for their bad grades in their letters of recommendation to employers, and he's just has lost his will to do good in the world, and he's just sitting in his office writing angry letters to get back at everyone. While I wouldn't want to know this person in real life, there's something really fun about seeing someone that sort of gets out every frustration you've ever felt all in one fell swoop.
Yes.
I just love his commentary. I love how pointed he is in everything that he writes and how much he invests into these letters.
Yeah.
It just cracked me up.
Yeah, I read that too, and I would agree that it was very funny. It was sort of like when you have an interaction and after the fact you think of all of the things
right.
you wish you had said.
Right.
He's writing everything that other people probably wish they could say or wish they could write as professors in that situation. So I thought it was really funny too.
And that's another one that reads really fast.
It does read really fast.
Letters.
Yes. Yeah. I'm a fan of the epistolary novel.
Yes.
I will get sucked into one no matter what.
What else do you have?
My next one is The Rosie Project by Graham Simsion. And this one is a novel. It's about a man named John Tillman, and he's a scientist. He's a geneticist who is brilliant, but he's very socially awkward. And he probably has Asperger's, but he doesn't recognize that he does. I mean, he's completely unaware that there's anything about him that isn't... He thinks the way he does things is just the right way to do things, and everybody else who doesn't do them that way is wrong. And he has decided he wants to get married, and so he goes about it the same way that he does anything else in his life, which is in a very methodical way and with a plan. And he always has to have a plan and a schedule. And so he goes on this date where, because of the ice cream that the woman chooses and this conversation they have about the type of ice cream she chooses, he decides that that's a deal breaker for him. And so because of that, he decides he's going to come up with a questionnaire to weed out the candidates before they ever even go out on a date and figure out who the perfect person is for him. And it's this 16-page questionnaire front and back. And it's with questions about their eating habits and their exercise habits, and it's all these very specific things that he thinks that he wants. So he's come up with this, and he has a friend who's also a professor at the school where he is, this scientist. A woman walks into his office one day named Rosie, and she has been sent to him by his friend. And he assumes it's as part of this wife project, and so he's assuming that she wants to go out on a date with him. But she actually is coming to him because she wants to find out who her biological father is, and she thinks that he can help her find it because he's a geneticist, and so he can help her figure out who, through genetics, is her biological father. So she is a bartender, and she is a PhD student, and she is nothing like anything that he has imagined that he would like in his life. So immediately they're kind of at odds with each other, but they work together because he agrees to help her find her father. And as they get to know each other, sort of an inner conflict, because he realizes that he actually likes spending time with her, and he actually finds her attractive, and all these things that you would think of in somebody you're interested in, but she meets none of his ideas of what his perfect wife would look like. And it's a really, really sweet story. It reminded me of a romantic comedy that you would see, like When Harry Met Sally, or one of those where you know where it's going, and it's just such a fun ride to get there. And he reminds me a lot of Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory,
oh, okay.
If you watch that show, where he's this kind of eeky scientist guy and just says what he's thinking all the time. And then Rosie was sort of like the Penny character, where she is so outside his sphere of what he knows, but helps lighten him up and make him more human because she brings out the person behind the scientist. It's really delightful and heartwarming, and like I said, it is predictable, but it goes exactly where you want it to be going, and it's very well paced. I really felt like it was written almost to be a movie, and that's not a negative in any way. Like, the way it plays out, it just felt like I was sitting for a few hours on my couch watching this fun, romantic movie. And in fact, I just read that Richard Linklater, who did Boyhood, and he did Dazed and Confused, is the other one I know, but I know he's done... Oh, he did the Behind Before Sunset
right,
movies,
that
too,
trilogy,
I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that trilogy. But anyway, he has signed on to direct a movie, and that Jennifer Lawrence is being rumored to play the part of Rosie.
Oh, okay.
We read this in my book club, and everybody really enjoyed it, even though at first you're sort of turned off maybe by the main character of Don, because he is so close-minded, and but then you see his growth as it goes along. Although he still remains very true to himself, you never get a complete turnaround of who this man is. And then Rosie's a great character. It's a really fun book and very funny. He has a really witty way of writing.
I need to read it. I know that I've heard you talk about it before. That's another one where I think, well, Hallie says to read it, so I should read it too. I seem to always pick classics when we do this, so I picked A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. And it's a very funny book with a very sad history. So in case you don't know the history, I'll tell you what happened with this book. So the author wrote the book in the early 1960s, and he couldn't get it published. And he ended up committing suicide in 1969, and it seems as though it's pretty much a result of not being able to get this book published. And after that, his mother tried to take it around to all these different publishers, couldn't get any, didn't have any success with that, and she finally gave it to the novelist Walker Percy, and he kind of became the champion of this book, and it was finally published in 1980, and then actually won the Pulitzer Prize in 1981. So it's a very kind of bittersweet story to the book, but that sort of makes it, I don't know, it makes me enjoy it a little bit more, just seeing how great this book is, and that it finally got the recognition it deserved. I seem to love books that have really unlikable characters, because this is the ultimate unlikable character. And it isn't even unlikable in the way where you sort of are like, well, but he's a good guy.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, the character from The Rosie Project has his eccentricities, but he's ultimately charming. This character is not a charming character at all. So his name is Ignatius Riley. And he's sort of the ultimate comic anti-hero. He's very large, he has very bad hygiene, he has very bad manners, and he basically hates everything about the world around him, and he's going to make sure everyone else knows what is wrong with them and where he finds them lacking. And he has the benefit of a really wonderful education, and he's taught college classes, he's a medievalist. When he was teaching, though, he was so rude to students that he's fired, and he hasn't worked since. So he lives with his mother, and he basically lives off her pension and floats along in life. He justifies this by claiming that he's writing this manuscript in what he calls a lengthy indictment against our century, which to me just sounds so awesome. So I just want to, you get to read parts of what he has to say, and they're so funny to me, because he's just so filled with bitterness and anger toward everything in the world.
Setting a theme on the characters.
I know,
that you like.
Why do I think this is so funny? Because I'm not like that in real life. I don't sit and think, if only we were still using our gramophones, everything would be better. But there's something about that kind of person that cracks me up. So the action starts out when his mother drives into a balcony, and they have to fund the rebuilding of this balcony for someone else. And she forces Ignatius to work, and so he has to go through these series of misadventures as he tries to hold down a job. I was writing down my favorite quotes and sort of favorite scenes, but there's really nothing worse than listening to someone try to describe why something is funny, and so I'm not going to do that. I'm not a dramatic reader, so I'm not going to submit to that. But it's really worth reading. There are a lot of things that are not at all PC in this book anymore, and there's a lot of stuff with kind of the physical and appearance humor that I don't particularly find funny and seems very dated to me. But it makes up for it with the way that Ignatius is trying to survive the world and all these things that he feels are his self-perceived genius not being appreciated. So since it's set in New Orleans, there's kind of this combination or this juxtaposition of kind of the sort of the laid back atmosphere of the South, which we, I think, both know, and then his very high education, the way that he talks to people is just so not the way people treat each other in the South. And so he has this really hyper intellectualism with his, that's surrounded by people that are sort of like, hey honey, it's okay, and he can't handle that kind of talk. So he'll do things like he'll watch like the equivalent of American Bandstand on television, and then scream at the television at all the horrible things these children are doing on television. And he'll go to movies and scream at the theater and tell everyone what's wrong with the movie. And he's just such a terrible person, but that's so funny to me. So it has a lot of kind of over-the-top absurd characters. It has this really colorful New Orleans setting. I think that if you can't handle really, really awkward situations. Like if you try to watch The Office and you can't handle that sort of
cringy.
Yeah, exactly. That level of awkwardness, this book is not for you. And I looked it up on Goodreads to see what other people were saying, and it seems very, very divisive, where people either love it or they absolutely can't stand it. And I think that if you know that going into reading this book, that you don't like that type of humor, then don't bother with it. But if you sort of love terrible people acting terribly, which I do, then you'll really, really enjoy this book.
Yeah, that's one that I have never read, but you always see it listed on best books of the century or funniest books, and
right.
It's definitely one that I need to read. Although I do like The Office, I don't know if I'll handle that secondhand embarrassment very well.
Yeah, I call it proxy shame.
Yeah, proxy shame.
But the writing is just really, really, really sharp,
uh-huh.
So that's also just a pleasure to read,
yes.
Even if that type of humor isn't exactly your thing. If you can find quotes from this book, maybe don't read the whole book if you can't handle that, but if you just find quotes online, which are very easy to find, there's so many good one-line things that Ignatius has to say that are really, really worth it.
Okay, I will add it to my list.
Good.
All right, so my last one is I've Got Your Number by Sophie Kinsella. And she is the author of the Shopaholic books, but this is one that's a standalone. It's not part of that series. And the premise, I'll say right from the outset, the premise is preposterous. You just sort of have to buy into it and go with it and suspend your disbelief, and it's a thoroughly enjoyable novel if you do. So Poppy Wyatt is about to get married in 10 days, and she's having this pre-wedding brunch with her friends. It's a champagne brunch. Champagne is flowing. It's at a fancy hotel. They're having a great time. And she is passing around her engagement ring to show her friends, and it's a family heirloom from her fiancé's family. And as they're passing around, there's a fire drill at the hotel. So they have to go outside, and in all the confusion, the ring goes missing.
Okay.
They don't know who had it last. They don't know where it went. So, of course, she flips out because this is her engagement ring. It's this family heirloom. She's trying to find it. And as she is looking for it, she's, you know, making every staff member at the hotel look for it. She goes out on the sidewalk to make a cell phone call because she doesn't get a signal in the building. And she's trying to call the police, and as she's trying to make the phone call, somebody rides by on a bike and grabs the phone out of her hand and steals it.
Okay.
So she has just given that cell phone number to everybody in the whole hotel, if they find it, to contact her, as well as the police. And as she's trying to figure out what to do, she discovers a cell phone in a trash can at the hotel. And so she picks it up and she decides, I'll use this phone. It was in the trash can. Obviously somebody doesn't need it. As I said, just go with the premise.
And you'll be fine.
So she takes the cell phone and she finds out the number of that one, and she goes back and tells everybody, use this number, we need to find my ring. It turns out that the cell phone was a company phone for an assistant to this businessman named Sam, and he is sort of he's a very successful businessman, but he's not a very seemingly kind of warm, happy person. He has an abrupt way and that sort of thing. So she begs him, he calls, thinking, of course, his assistant still has the phone, and she answers, and he said, well, give me my phone back, who is this? And she pleads with him to let her keep it because she needs to get her ring back. And so he agrees for a short temporary time that she can keep it until she finds her ring. All she has to do is make sure to send him all the texts and emails that are coming to his personal assistant's old phone, because the way his life was set up with work, his assistant dealt with everything. Like he got so many emails and so many texts from people that she was sort of the barrier between him and these other people. And so she has to agree to forward them. So she agrees, Poppy agrees, because she wants to make sure, of course, to be able to keep the phone. But she can't just simply forward everything that comes in for him and leave it at that. She can't help but read some of them, and she is a very warm-hearted person and very caring and a little bit meddlesome, but in the most genuine way. She's just trying to do what she thinks is best. And so she sees some of the texts that are coming in and the emails that are coming in, and she tries to first encourage Sam to respond in a way that she thinks would be a little bit warmer than his abrupt way of responding to his coworkers and the people he supervises and things. And then ultimately starts responding on her own to these and as him, as
oh
if
gosh.
She is him, she starts responding. So when somebody in the office's dog dies, she sends an e-card as a condolence card, and that's something that he would never do, but she writes it from him. And so it is so funny, and you can't help but root for her, even though at the same time you're thinking, no, stop doing this. This is going to turn out so badly. You know, it's like this train wreck waiting to happen. But it is so funny, and you really just want the best for her. What I liked about it especially is her fiance, even though you sense that as she and Sam, the businessman, are becoming closer because they're texting back and forth and they're talking to each other, her fiance, you sense, maybe isn't exactly right for her. She's very intimidated by his family. They're all academics, and she is a physical therapist, and she feels very, very intimidated by them, and she feels like they look down on her. And it's clear from the beginning they don't want her to marry their son. But her fiance is not a bad guy at all, and so it's not like he's the villain and that you just think, get out of that relationship. You see why she is in the relationship with him. And, you know, she only has a week until her wedding, and so she's all crazed trying to plan her wedding and at the same time developing this relationship with Sam. And it's just hilarious, and it's so delightful, and she is a very endearing character. And always when I read Sophie Kinsella's books, the way I describe them is that they just sparkle. Like, they're very frothy and fizzy and fun. And if you're looking for a good beach read like that, I would recommend this highly, because it's such a fun story, and Poppy is a fun, delightful character.
Yeah, I haven't read that one, but I read a couple of the Shopaholic books.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just something super appealing about, even though she's making terrible decisions,
yes,
and you know that they're not things that are going to serve her well,
yes,
there's still something really, really endearing,
yes,
about that.
Well, and I would say, because I liked the Shopaholic books, I don't read them anymore because I got a little bit frustrated by the fact that she wasn't learning from her mistakes.
Right.
And
I don't know how much I could take beyond the two.
She ends up with a child, and when she has a baby, I was like,
that's just your
learn personal finance. But in this one, I felt like you sort of understand why Poppy is scrambling and why she's doing some of those things. And as I said, it all comes from a good place when she starts meddling in his life. She thinks that it will improve everybody's situations if she does these things. And so she's such a good heroine that you want to be friends with. So I love those kinds of books.
Yeah. Okay, so my last book is Assassination Vacation by Sarah Vowell. I think this is, when I was thinking about what I like in a humor book, I think this is my favorite type. I would classify it as the humor essayist. So I would put people like David Sedaris or John Hodgman also in this category. And I sort of think of it as people that are super, super smart, and instead of destroying the world, they decide to write really funny books with their super smarts. And so I'm grateful for that. They tend to kind of have these eccentricities that they are very aware of, and they hone in on them, and they're willing to play them up or use them for the sake of these books. Even though it's a memoir, I guess it kind of could be seen as the same way as like the Jen Lancaster,
mm-hmm,
books, or Jenny Lawson.
Oh, I almost talked about
that
book. Let's Pretend This Never Happened.
Right.
I almost talked about that today.
Which are a little bit more like My Life is Crazy. These are the crazy things that happened to me. And it kind of has that same vein, but it's more being aware of their geekiness and wanting to milk that for humor. So while there's still crazy things that happen in this book, it kind of is celebrating the geek side of it versus just the crazy side of it. So Sarah Vowell is just a huge history nerd. She loves history, she loves American history. And so this book has like actual in-depth history information in it, but it sort of celebrates her, how nerdy it is that she wants to learn about it in all the forms that she can. So the structure of a book is based on road trips where she's going on these trips to see sites affiliated with presidential assassinations on her vacation time, which I know for a lot of people that does not seem like a fun time, but I kind of identified with this a little bit. So maybe not necessarily presidential assassinations, but like weird history moments, I would totally drive for that. So I like it for that reason. But she's really, really fascinated by these things, and she's fascinated with the idea of historical tourism and what these moments in history have meant for the bigger cultural picture. So while lots of people go to places, like people go to Gettysburg or go to other battle sites, she wants to know every single thing she can about them and all the characters that play into these different moments in history. So she finds out all this bizarre stuff besides just the kind of textbook facts. So she includes tons of these, and a couple that I'll point out is that or I'll point out that she points out that Robert Todd Lincoln, who is the son of Abraham Lincoln, was president or was present at 3 presidential assassinations. So she calls him Jinxie McDad. And then the man that ended up assassinating James Garfield belonged to a religious cult in upstate New York, which believed in free love, but no one wanted to have sex with him, so he sued them. And you don't get that kind of history when you're in school.
No.
So you need Sarah Vowell to fill in those
gaps. It would make history class much more interesting if you did.
More fun. So she has this intense love of history, but she's not there to really mock the presidents. She's there because she actually has really, really deep respect for them and a sense of veneration for them. But she's more poking fun at herself for the fact that she wants to know all this besides the facts and information. But there's definitely some political commentary in the book. She wrote it in 2005, and so it's in the midst of the Iraq War, so she kind of makes some parallels there. But there's serious criticism that's going on in her writing. But I think the main theme of the book, or the tone of the book, is just this lighthearted look at sort of the crazy things that have happened that we don't know about in our own history. I listened to this book, the first time I read it, it was the audiobook, and she read it, and she sort of has this peculiar
yes.
voice, but it fits so well
yeah.
with what she's talking about.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're a first-time Sarah Vowell reader, you should go with the audiobook, because she really brings sort of the kind of, she just has this really dry sort of droll voice that she does for her reading, and it's just really, really well done.
Yes, that's sort of David Sedaris.
Yes,
same
exactly.
Way. The person who has written the stories, reading them,
mm-hmm.
there's something about the way they deliver them that
mm-hmm.
makes it even funnier than if you just read them on
right.
the page.
So that's Assassination Vacation by Sarah Vowell. And that brings us to what we're reading this week.
So I just finished The Life Intended by Kristen Harmel. I think it's Harmel, maybe Harmel, H-A-R-M-E-L. It is about a woman named Kate Waithman, and she lost her husband very suddenly 12 years prior to the book opening. I shouldn't say that. She loses her husband at the beginning of the book, and then it flashes to 12 years later. And she's about to turn 40. She's like maybe late 30s. Just about to turn 40. And so she has tried very hard to move on with her life, but it's been very difficult. She has really felt the loss of her husband this whole time. And she has been dating a perfect on paper sort of a guy where it seems like they should be the perfect couple, but she feels like something's maybe missing, that they don't, even though they don't really ever fight or anything, she feels like maybe that means there's an underlying lack of passion, and they don't really ever talk about their pasts, and she feels like there are things about her that he doesn't know, but yet why rock the boat, because things seem to be going really well, and she thinks maybe that's just the way life is because she lost her first husband, and maybe she'll never feel that all-encompassing love that she felt for him, and this is just what love will be like and what marriage will be like in the future. And he proposes, and she accepts because she feels like it's what she should do, and at the same time she discovers she can't have children, and her now fiancé is okay with that. He says, that's not a problem. You know, I'm late 30s, early 40s. That it may not have happened anyway. And so that's fine. He's totally fine with their life the way it is. But she feels this sort of nagging feeling of guilt because of moving on from her husband. And she starts having these vivid dreams where her former husband is still alive and they have a 12-year-old daughter who is deaf. They're so vivid that she almost feels like it's like an alternate reality. There are bits of these dreams where things that are then popping up in her real life that are the same, and she thinks, well, how would I have known that if this wasn't true, if this wasn't really happening somewhere or somehow? Because the dreams are so real to her, it prompts her to start taking a sign language class so she can communicate with the daughter that is deaf in the dreams. And the sign language class that she takes, the man who teaches it is involved in the foster care system, and she is a music therapist, and he starts talking to her about what music therapy is, and it's for kids. She's a music therapist for kids. And he starts talking to her about what music therapy is and how it can help people, and her excuse for why she's taking the sign language class is that there have been advancements in musical therapy for hard of hearing children, and so that's why she wants to do it, because of course she doesn't want to admit the reason she's taking sign language is because she's dreaming she has this daughter that is deaf. And when he hears that, he asks her if she'd be willing to start volunteering with some children he knows who are in foster care, who are hard of hearing, who are having a difficult time, and maybe it would help them open up and start communicating a little bit more if she were to help them. So she agrees, and as she starts doing that, it really opens up to her this whole idea that maybe the life that she's been leading isn't the life that she was meant to be leading, that she's been, it's almost like a lesser life. She's been not living her full life because she's been grieving for her husband for so long. And she starts questioning the choices that she's making. And utmost in her mind is both her relationship with the man that she's engaged to and the fact that she can't have children and what that means, and that these foster children come into her life, and she starts realizing how much she really does like being around them and that she's pretty good at doing this, and she starts questioning whether she is truly okay with not being able to have kids. And I think that's all I'm going to say about the story. I think that that's enough of an idea of what it's about, but it really struck a chord with me. I think that a lot of people can identify with looking back on things that have happened in your life, both good and bad, and realizing how they molded you into the person that you've become. And that even though sometimes you look back and wish things hadn't happened, you don't know what your life would look like if they hadn't. You know, if you think it was something bad that happened to you, but maybe something good came of it that would never have happened if that original bad thing hadn't happened. And that's the case for her. Obviously, her husband died, which nobody would ever, ever wish on anybody. But the life that she's intended to lead is perhaps a better life than she would have had if he had lived. And maybe the time they had together was enough to lead her in this direction. Although I thought some of the surprises that happened in the book later on in the book were telegraphed early on, it didn't lessen my enjoyment of it at all. I really felt like the journey that she took is worthwhile, and it struck a chord with me, and I identified with some of the things that she goes through. And so even though in the back of my mind, I sort of knew what was going to happen, it didn't lessen my enjoyment of it at all. And I just loved it. I just loved the story. It was one that I was sad when it was over. I really enjoyed being a part of the story and a part of her life. And anything having to do with foster children always touches me a lot. The Language of Flowers, I don't know if you've read that one. That's when I walked. And then the book actually I read right before soon before The Life Intended had a story about a foster parent. And there's something about children that don't have families and maybe don't feel wanted, and it just tugs at the heartstrings no matter what. I just love this book. I thought it was really great. So that's The Life Intended by Kristen Harmel. And next up, I will say I'm reading the new Harper Lee book, which I'm a little nervous about because I've read some very mixed reviews, but maybe I'll talk about that one next time. All right, what are you reading now?
So I read a YA book called When I Was the Greatest by Jason Reynolds. This was released last year. It's his debut novel. It's set in Brooklyn. It's kind of a rough neighborhood of Brooklyn. And the main character is Ali, who's, I think he's 15 years old. And he lives with his mom and his little sister. And he has a dad that's kind of around, but doesn't live with the family. I don't think his parents ever got married. And his mom was very, very serious about work and school and living a really solid life. And his dad did a lot of illegal stuff, and so she kicked him out. And so he's kind of in the picture, but not really at the beginning of the book. So because he has his mom that really pushes him, he does well in school, and he's taking boxing lessons from his neighbor. He gets his nickname, Ali, from that. And I actually can't remember what his real name is, but they just call him Ali through the whole book. So his best friend is his neighbor, who is nicknamed Noodles. His little sister gives nicknames like just right and left, and so all these characters have nicknames, and you just focus on those, so I don't know the real names of any of the characters. But he has this best friend named Noodles, and Noodles doesn't have a really good parent figure. His mom isn't around at all, and his dad is out of the picture completely. So Noodles gets into a lot of trouble, and he's really aggressive really quickly. He seems to always want to cheat the system somehow, and so there's an episode of shoplifting that he gets Ali in trouble for. But Noodles has an older brother named Needles who has Tourette's syndrome. I know, the nicknames are incredible. Noodles has his older brother Needles who has Tourette's syndrome, and so all he does is sit on the stoop of their brownstone and knits, and he raps. And so these are the things that sort of control his syndrome. But Noodles is really embarrassed by Needles, so he treats him really badly and is just kind of rough with him. So there's all kind of this backstory you get at the beginning of the book. Noodles eventually wants to go to a party that's being thrown by his girlfriend, or it's more his crush, but he sees her as a girlfriend. And it's put on by her older brother, and it's meant for adults, and these are all 15-year-old boys. I think Noodles is maybe 16. So she invites him and says that Ali can come, but they can only come on the condition that Noodles can come with them. And so she thinks that will just make them not want to come at all, yeah. But they say, okay, we'll do it. So when they get there, it's really clear that they're there over their heads. And then things turn bad really quickly because this is just not a good situation for kids to be in. And especially someone who's dealing with the syndrome that Needles has, it just is a really bad situation. So the remainder of the book is dealing with sort of the fallout from this party that they go to. So there's serious issues of being a good kid, but getting involved in things that you shouldn't have been involved in, even when you have all the best intentions of the world, that sometimes just bad things happen to people. I really liked that it sort of dealt with the family dynamic after that and how the parents come together to figure out what to do in the situation and how parents really influence a lot in what your life, in what will happen in your life and what they'll do in order to make sure that their kids' lives are better than how their lives turned out. So it's kind of out of my comfort zone of what I usually read. This was something for a book club and I don't typically do like YA for boys, but I think that that's an important genre to read.
Yeah.
So I was impressed with it. I was glad. I'm glad for those instances when I have to read outside my comfort zone.
Yeah.
That's really, to me, the benefit of book clubs.
I totally agree. There are so many books that we read in my book club that
right.
I think, well, it may have been on my radar, but I don't know
right.
that it would ever have gone to the top of my to-read list except
yeah.
for the book club.
Right.
And I'm always thankful that I read it. Even
right.
if it's not my favorite book ever, I'm just thankful that I had these.
Yeah,
books.
It's a different perspective.
Yeah.
It's a perspective I wouldn't really
yes.
know otherwise. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked it.
Good.
Okay, do you want to review what you
yes.
read this week?
So I talked about Text from Jane Eyre by Mallory Ortberg, The Rosie Project by Graham Simsion, I've Got Your Number by Sophie Kinsella, and what I read this week was The Life Intended by Kristen Harmel.
Okay, and I talked about Dear Committee Members by Julie Schumacher, A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole, Assassination Vacation by Sarah Vowell, and what I read this week was When I Was the Greatest by Jason Reynolds. If you want to get in touch with us to give us feedback or a suggestion on a topic you'd like to discuss, you can email us at wellreadpod@gmail.com or on Twitter @wellreadpodcast. Please rate and review us on iTunes. That helps us get more attention. Or you can rate us on your other podcast provider of choice. Our theme music is Kitten by Poddington Bear. We keep our show notes at BeaufortCountyLibrary.org/wellread, and you can find a listing of every book we've talked about on this episode. Thank you for listening, and happy reading.